Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 6th of April. All things political this hour with Lisa Mascaro. She is from the Los Angeles Times, where she covers U.S. policy, economics, and political culture. She's a Los Angeles area native, and she is reported across Southern California, so the drought will be one of the things we'll be talking about this hour of our program. She also worked for the Las Vegas Sun, and she contributed as the paper won the Pulitzer Prize for public service. We have a lot to be talking about this hour. President Obama calls the preliminary agreement with Iran a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to curb the spread of nuclear weapons in a dangerous region. But today, Israel's Minister of Intelligence and Strategic Affairs presented a list of requirements that it wants in a final deal, and Prime Minister Netanyahu appeared on all three TV news shows yesterday, said on one of them, "I'm not trying to kill any deal, I'm trying to kill a bad deal." California Governor Jerry Brown orders a 25% cut in water consumption. Will everybody be moving to Wisconsin now, we ask. Senator Robert Menendez, ranking Democrat on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, receives a 68-page indictment on bribery and conspiracy charges. This has been called the first significant campaign corruption case evolving out of the Citizens United decision. On April 13, Marco Rubio will say that he's running for president. Rand Paul kicks off his Stand with Rand tour tomorrow. We welcome phone calls all hours, as we always do. And here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's @KDunnShow. Lisa, hello. Thanks for joining us again. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. Let's start with the drought in California, because you're from California. A 25% reduction in water consumption. How is that going to affect people who live in California? And, you know, it looks like it's going to create, unless this drought lifts sometime year or some year soon, going to create substantial problems for the state.
Yeah, you know, I think what was so interesting, and I haven't lived in California for a few years now since I've been back in where I'm at now in Washington, D.C., but I will tell you, having grown up out there and spent a lot of my life there, there are always these restrictions, right? You know, we go through these years of ups and downs with the drought. I think what was so startling and so newsworthy about what Governor Brown did last week was that it was the first ever mandatory restriction. This is on everybody across the board. You know, they have to cut this 25%. Now, there are some allowances being made for the growers, but all of your residents and businesses are going to have to do this. And I think what was, to your point, even sort of more maybe startling for folks was that there doesn't really seem to be an easy way out for the future, that this is potentially the new norm. And I think that will substantially change, you know, the way homes are built and businesses are run and people, you know, landscape and recreate, all of that.
Right.
And, you know, it was interesting in the Los Angeles Times over the weekend, there was a really interesting story about the discrepancy in water use, and you really see higher water use per capita in some of the wealthier enclaves where, you know, the sort of more famous places people might know about, of course, Beverly Hills, Malibu, but, you know, there are lots of these wonderful, you know, homes and gardens, and, you know, the landscape just isn't going to be able to sort of handle that
right.
in years to come, and so people have to start thinking differently. I don't know if we'll see the, you know, sort of Southern Nevada, Las Vegas style, you know, rock gardens out front, but you know, you definitely, even in the past decade, have seen so much more interest in, you know, drought-tolerant planting and water-resistant, energy-efficient appliances. And I think that's just going to have to increase if the state's going to, you know, not put itself in a real bind.
And what about crops, Lisa? Will there be a change in what's grown in California?
Yeah, you know, I'm less familiar with that, though I was catching up with some of our coverage from the Central Valley over the weekend, and I know there's a little bit of a debate out there because it was said that, you know, the growers didn't get hit as hard as some of the others, some of the residential and other commercial ventures, but there is concern. You know, of course, we know almonds are a hugely, you know, the state produces, what, you know, 90% or something of the country's almonds, and, you know, that's a hugely water-intensive crop, and so at this point, you know, I think what they're saying is not mandated changes from the state in what folks can grow, but I think it's just going to be on the growers themselves to sort of, you know, look at what they can afford and what's going to make sense.
Right. Well, let's move to Iran. President Obama calling this preliminary agreement a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to curb the spread of nuclear weapons in a dangerous region. He, of course, faces substantial opposition, although I believe he has an assurance from the Republican leadership they'll hold off until details on this are finalized. But you have Prime Minister Netanyahu on three of the news talk shows yesterday morning. He's leading a campaign against this and some other Arab nations. What do you make of this? Is there any possibility of President Obama getting anything that he really wants from this deal, or is it dead in the water?
Yeah, you know, I think we are in a moment of sort of high suspense on this right now. Congress, of course, is away. They're out of town for the spring, you know, Easter Passover recess. They will come back next Monday. And on Tuesday, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, chaired by Senator Bob Corker, will begin marking up and holding a vote on this legislation that would require, you know, any deal to come before Congress for approval. And you know, even though Congress was away, you heard a lot of conversation on the Sunday shows, and I know my inbox has been filled, and I know there are a lot of conversations happening by these senators and lawmakers while they're all scattered around the country and around the world on what they think. And there are just a lot of details that the lawmakers want to know more about. Namely, they don't want to allow the administration to have the approval to lift or ease or suspend the sanctions, and until Congress says so. And, you know, that's the real sticking point now with the administration, because the administration wants to be able to sort of, you know, give its word that it will be able to do that, or is afraid that Congress would tie its hands and disallow that. And that's what, you know, is going to be sort of coming for this vote in the committee, and then eventually, I would imagine, in the weeks to come, a vote on the floor that would say, you know, if there is a deal, Congress wants to weigh in. And, you know, it's tough for the administration right now. Republicans, a lot of Republicans don't like this deal, and a number of Democrats are, not that they don't like it, but they are concerned, and they are raising questions. And I think until the next 90 days here, when the administration is able to produce a real document that folks can kind of sink their teeth into, you know, the jury's still going to be out on whether this thing will fly.
And it would appear that even the president discusses kind of a leap of faith here with his comments that he remains uncertain about the intentions of the supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. He's a pretty tough read, President Obama said. Was it probably better for him to have not said that?
You know, that was an interesting interview Saturday with the columnist from the New York Times that, of course, everyone's been sort of talking about and parsing those words. It was interesting. I thought I don't know if it was wise or not wise for him to say that, but I thought it was interesting. I thought, though, that what you really saw in that was what, you know, the columnist Tom Friedman sort of said, you know, his thought of the Obama doctrine that, you know, let's open the door and see what we can do. We can always say no, right? And that seems to be, you know, the president's approach. Of course, that makes, you know, members of Congress very nervous and very concerned that, you know, he's not getting a good deal. He could be getting a better deal. But I think there is this real willingness by the president to just, you know, let's go down this road. The president also in that interview, you know, noted that he'd had, you know, had this interaction with the prime minister and the others in the leadership in Iran and felt like, you know, they were willing to sort of, you know, open the country a little bit and try this new way of doing business with the West. And, you know, again, let's see what they come up with. I think both sides, you know, are trying to sort of sell the deal to their home audiences at this point. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, making them seem a little bit at odds with each other. You know, the Iranians have to sort of sell the deal with what they think are the best points. Of course, the president is trying to get Americans and members of Congress to lean into the deal. And, you know, they have different constituencies, you know, that they're sort of trying to speak to.
And what about Prime Minister Netanyahu? I'm trying to remember a time in recent history where you have the prime minister or president of a country come and speak to Congress when the president specifically didn't want him to come. Then he's on all the Sunday morning talk shows. He's just all over the place now. Who's he speaking to?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is a real first. You know, I think he is speaking to the American people, but he is also certainly speaking, you know, to the hardliners in Israel and to the, you know, he just won his election and re-election. And, you know, a lot of that conversation when he came to speak to Congress was, you know, just weeks before his election. And he was certainly, you know, I think that speech, that very hardline speech that he gave in Congress here in the United States, you know, certainly had to resonate with his voters back home who want that kind, you know, those of them who do want that kind of hardline approach. You know, it was certainly a first to have the Congress invite a prime minister without sort of, you know, letting the White House in on it first. And Speaker Boehner, of course, made that invitation and has sort of stood by it. But, you know, I think a lot of folks do, you know, do see this this wedge, you know, that is sort of happening. Of course, the president in that same interview Saturday talked a little bit about his discomfort with being seen as, you know, not being supportive enough of Israel. And the president said in that interview, you know, how he sort of personally, felt, you know, upset by that. And I think Democrats have always had a strong relationship with Israel, of course, Republicans too, but I think there's now a bit of a wedge there that Democrats are certainly not happy about. And so, you know, the whole outcome of this, I think, will definitely be sort of something that sets the table for what that relationship will be like down the road.
And the press started to say that there was a new Obama doctrine over the weekend. Do you see such a doctrine emerging? And if so, what is it?
Yeah, you know, I don't cover the White House, so I'm a little hesitant to wade further than I have. I mean, I think there was definitely, you know, that sort of statement again, you know, in the other paper, based on Tom Friedman's interview. But I think it was that, you know, I think the president was quoted in that interview of saying, you know, similar to what he's doing with Cuba, you know, it's this idea of using the country's, the U.S.'s strength, I think the president was saying, you know, as a point of confidence that we can engage these other countries that we have not, you know, engaged with as much in the past. And I think the president, the doctrine, I guess, if you would call it that, was that, you know, let's try, you know, let's see, we can always say no, you know. But I think there's a lot of criticism of that, right, as well, you know, how you know, sort of not taking, you know, a harder stance. You know, you heard Lindsey Graham, for example, the Republican senator from South Carolina, on the shows over the weekend saying something that he and a lot of the other Republican senators have always say, which is that they don't think that the president projects a strong enough hand, and that, you know, he's not able to, you know, get the deal he wants because he's not an imposing figure who,
right,
you know, feel that the people on the other side feel threatened by, whether it be Putin or the Ayatollah, or, yeah, you know. So, you know, so we'll see. But I do think there is this doctrine, as you say, sort of emerging.
Graham's comments were interesting. Didn't he say something about any Republican candidate, except perhaps for Rand Paul, could be more effective a leader, a tougher leader. Even Hillary Clinton would be tougher than President Obama is.
Yes, I did notice those comments as well. And, you know, I think part of that is, you know, you do see this constant tweaking of the president by, you know, Senator Graham, Senator McCain, some of the real defense hawks, you know, who wish that and want the president to be stronger. So you do see that tweaking. Of course, you know, Speaker Boehner, you know, has said as much in different language, you know. So there's a little bit, I would think, of a little bit of a sort of partisan edge to some of that. But I think for a lot of these guys, they do see it that way. You know, they come from that school of, you know, fight might with might. And, you know, that's what they would rather see in the U.S. leader.
We're going to take phone calls in a moment. Let's talk a little bit. We haven't talked that much, and he certainly has this base that's very faithful to him. I'm wondering if there's a chance that Rand Paul, who kicks off his Stand With Rand tour tomorrow in this country, has any chance of becoming the Republican nominee, and why it is that he seems to be somewhat, not ignored, because he says some interesting things, but he's never really given a chance, and yet he has a very enthusiastic group of followers.
Absolutely. So Senator Paul this morning sent out a little teaser video for a preview of his announcement tomorrow that he's going to be making down in Louisville to kick off, presumably, his presidential campaign. And the opening scene of his video is this interview with CNN's Candy Crowley, where she's saying, you know, the most interesting person in the Republican. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. You know, I think Senator Paul is one of the more interesting people in the Republican Party right now. Now, whether or not that parlays into, you know, a potential presidential run, we're a long way from there. As you say, he has a very strong base, built largely from the enthusiasm for his father, the former congressman and former presidential candidate Ron Paul, who, of course, retired from Congress and is no longer running. But, you know, that is that very strong libertarian wing of the party.
Right.
Some of it is aligned with sort of what had been the Tea Party movement. I don't know if we really have an official Tea Party movement still, but we have a lot of that very center-right, you know, I don't mean center, I mean right of center, you know, sort of very libertarian streak within the Republican Party. And Rand has inherited and capitalized on a lot of that, and these are a lot of young people, a lot of millennials, a lot of people who are very good at social media, at organizing, showing up at his campaign rallies, showing up at his opponents' rallies, you know, and really making the case. And Senator Paul has done this really fascinating outreach, you know, trying to build the Republican Party in areas where it really needs a lot of help, you know, in minority communities. You know, he opened the Republican office in Detroit, Michigan. He spoke to Howard University, a historic black college here in Washington, D.C. So all that is sort of on the positive side for Rand Paul's trajectory. I think on the flip side, you know, you're seeing a number of stories coming out, and I know thinking about this myself, is exactly who is Rand Paul these days. You know, he came in on sort of the Tea Party wave in the Senate of 2010, very strong libertarian principles, had this very famous, one of the first, you know, the real filibusters in the Senate that we'd seen in recent years, when he stood up and talked about the U.S. policy for drone strikes. You know, very libertarian, and he has since now sort of shifted some of those thinkings. He's become, you know, he had this famous essay in, I think it was Time magazine last year, when he said, "I am not an isolationist," you know, and he was trying to show that he wasn't such a libertarian that he would be, you know, opposed to any U.S. intervention, especially with, you know, as we were thinking of the rise of ISIS and the problems in the Middle East. And, you know, you saw this vote last week, or 2 weeks ago in the Senate, where he proposed, you know, increasing defense spending, you know, now different than his colleagues, his would be paid for. But, you know, those kinds of things are not what, you know, sort of hardcore libertarians would expect. And so I think that's going to be a little challenge for him as he presents himself, you know, exactly who is he, and is he sort of his father's sort of ideological system, or is he something other, and can that still generate the enthusiasm that, you know, that he had been building, or will people drop off? Will supporters drop off if they perceive him as, you know, kind of a little more moderate, right, or a little more mainstream?
Lisa Mascaro is our guest, and you're listening to All Things Political here on the Ideas Network. She covers Congress for the Los Angeles Times. She covers U.S. policy and economics, among other topics, and we're looking at politics and starting, of course, with this preliminary agreement that has been reached with Iran. Although there is a huge amount of opposition to it, there will be details and maybe somewhat altered agreement reached by the end of June. What do you think of all the politicking around this? Do you see a new Obama doctrine emerging? We talked about Rand Paul a little bit. Feel free to talk about Marco Rubio or how the Republican race seems to be. I can't believe we're talking about it, but we are. It's a long way away where everything seems to be in that race. We have yet to talk about, which I think is fascinating, this Senator Robert Menendez, who's the ranking Democrat on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, received a 68-page indictment on bribery and conspiracy charges. When you look at some of this, some of the money went to the super PACs, and what people are worried about is if you give a whole lot of money and you somehow that money gets directed to the member of Congress and then they want a favor from you because they gave you a lot of money, you'll do the favor. And there seems to be an element of that in this case with a doctor in Florida who gave a whole lot of money, not directly to Menendez. But is this an outgrowth of the Citizens United decision? Will we be seeing more of this? Well, we can talk about that as well. The drought in California, we will do a full hour on this coming up this week. I'm not sure what day yet, but it seems to be a pretty significant thing for the governor of that state to order a 25% cut in water consumption across the board. You think of all the people who moved to California over the past 25 or 30 years. Will it be the end of that kind of growth? Because you can't grow very well if you don't have water. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Lines are open for you right now. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, @KDunnShow. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's welcome phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number for Lisa Mascaro this hour. She covers Congress for the LA Times, and we go to Gary in Glendale, our first caller. Hi, Gary.
Good afternoon, Kathleen. Thank you.
Thank you.
Your voice just faded down, so I hope I'm coming in okay.
Yeah, you're fine.
Okay. My question has to do with the news coverage of the negotiations with Iran. NPR has been good about it this past week, but practically other news source and make it out as if it's a bilateral duel in the sands between John Kerry and the Iranian foreign minister, when the entire permanent members of the Security Council plus Germany are involved with it. And as a bottom line, the agreements as it reached will have as much concern about the security of Israel, despite what Prime Minister Netanyahu is ranting about periodically. But it's presented as if it's a one-on-one when it really isn't. It's a six-on-one under the auspices of the United Nations. And subsequently, your guests can straighten it out. If an agreement is reached, it will probably go through the Security Council first before it comes to Congress for ratification, which is the constitutional right of Congress.
Thank you, Gary. Lisa.
Okay, and I was just looking as we were talking because I know our State Department reporter who was reporting on the talks from Switzerland, our lead that day was when the deal was, or the outlines was announced, was something like, you know, it was six, you know, Western nations and Iran. So it was definitely not sort of portrayed as a bilateral, talk or a deal in our coverage here in the LA Times, and I was going to try and pull that link and put it out on Twitter so he could see some just a little bit of the way our paper was covering it. And then, you know, the terms of what he says ratification is really what's sort of at the core here of this debate in Congress is, you know, the administration doesn't necessarily believe that the deal needs to be, quote unquote, ratified by Congress. You know, this is something that would be agreed to by these nations, and yes, through through other channels, and you know, what kind of role would Congress play in an advisory capacity or in a capacity that could actually scuttle the deal? And you know, that is really the core of the debate here in the U.S. And I am sorry, I can't say exactly how the international partners, would ratify, I guess, or agree to it. I'm not sure if that goes exactly what the stages are to do that. But I mean, that issue that he raises is exactly the problem here in the U.S. or the concern is can if Congress does weigh in, you know, to what extent would it be binding and would it potentially prevent what the U.S. has been a party to, and then of course sort of scuttle the entire thing. The Congress hasn't fully decided what it wants to do on that, and so we'll see what they come back with.
Thanks, Gary, for your call. Let's go to Ned in Wausau. Hi, Ned.
Hi.
Hi.
I know John Kerry a little bit, having spoken one-on-one with him for 2 minutes back when he ran for president. And I feel that the United States is very lucky to have him as a leader in these six nations that negotiated with Iran. The world is a safer place because of his outstanding leadership. Now, here's part of the agreement that has passed so far between the two countries as a suggestion. And the first is that they would be able to verify, which we can't do right now, the stopping of nuclear fuel generation, and they know where the centrifuges are, and they're going to have inspectors that are going to have access to them, and if Iran does not abide by the agreement, then the sanctions will go back on, and it'll be just like it is today. Now, if we what we have here is the greatest chance for peace between Iran and many other countries that we've had for a long time. And I think the verification process, which was nicely outlined on the front page of USA Today Weekend Edition, I think is really an important part of this process. And I think that Benjamin Netanyahu on the three Sunday morning talk shows is asking for something that's totally unrealistic. It will never happen in this century. Never would Iran agree to what he asked them to do. So what you've got is if Netanyahu gets his way and all the conservatives that agree with him, then you're going to simply have what we have today, no verification, with no way of inspectors coming in and checking whether there's any nuclear fuel development.
Lisa.
Yeah, I mean that's one of the hang-ups, is what happens in the sanction. I mean, in the inspection regime, and that's going to be again, one of these thorny questions that they have to get to when they see the final deal. What we've got now is just a framework, and let's see. But will the inspectors be able to get in? On what frequency will they be able to get in? And then when you start looking down the road of what quantity of centrifuges will be allowed to be maintained and what capacity will the Iranians be allowed to continue, in a non-military aspect of the production. That's all information that will need to be part of that final deal and is really, I hate to sound trite, but it's like the devil's in the details, right? I mean, when that stuff comes out, then folks can decide whether they feel it's good deal or a bad deal.
Thanks very much, Ned, for your call. Our phone number, lines are open now, 800-486-8655. It is All Things Political, which you always hear Mondays at 1. We've been talking about the preliminary agreement with Iran a good portion of the hour, but feel free to move us in other directions, too, politically related directions, because that's what we talk about on Mondays. We'd be happy to hear from you. Let's spend a little bit of time talking about Menendez and this indictment. 68-page indictment, bribery and conspiracy charges. He's a fairly influential Democrat, ranking Democrat on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. I read a few pieces over the weekend that looked at how this may be one of the outgrowths of the Citizen United, that he was given a lot of money, but not directly to him, by a super PAC from some doctor who then Menendez did some favors for. Some of the money went Menendez's way in some other ways. You know, it really points to some problems, lots of problems with campaign finance and what you can do and what you can't do. But it seems pretty obvious if you're taking a lot of money, however it's funneled to you from somebody, and you do favors for them later, that's pretty simple to understand.
It's really a going to be a first key test, right? And we haven't had a big case like this coming out of the Senate for, you know, practically a decade now. And, you know, what happened at the Citizens United decision was that ability for wealthier donors to go through what had been the previous caps, right? So there's much more ability now to donate more freely and to donate to these super PACs, these outside of the traditional party infrastructure organizations. And, you know, it was so interesting because Senator Menendez, you know, in a very defiant, you know, way, when the indictment came down, you know, and he stood up at a press conference in New Jersey and he said, you know, I'm not going anywhere. And he said, look, you've mistaken friendship, you know, for some, you know, some ulterior motives. He's like, this is just a friendship. And I think, you know, that's what's going to be so critical for the prosecution to be able to show that this was really a quid pro quo and, you know, and that this violated, you know, the sort of bribery statutes. But what it didn't violate was, you know, the ability for wealthy people to give a lot of money to a lot of of candidates. And the Supreme Court justices who dissented said, you know, this is what's going to happen. There is going to be this enormous pressure on lawmakers who are the recipients of this, you know, these, you know, truckloads of money to sort of feel, under pressure from these donors. And, you know, of course, that view on the court did not hold, but you know, we are seeing sort of the first test of that. One of my colleagues here, David Savage, who covers the courts, had a very another colleague here, Tim Phelps, I'm sorry, who covers the Justice Department, had a very interesting story a couple days ago in the LA Times where he talked about you know, when you're looking at this enormous case that the prosecution has put together, this very ambitious case, actually, despite all the sort of, you know, details that are very sort of interesting with all the money and the sort of splendor that was, you know, these hotel rooms and some of the women involved, he said, you know, the case could come down to being decided on one very simple point. You know, was there not proper disclosure on the senator's financial statements? You know, so, you know, again, this is that new era of fundraising. And I think, you know, heading into the 2016 election, I know we've been doing some early coverage on that. And, you know, with a number of candidates running, particularly, of course, on the Republican side, you know, not as many on the Democratic side, you know, that this election, people are saying, is going to be, you know, again, a record breaker in terms of campaign finance, you know, how much money is being poured in to these candidates.
Well, and then you have Jeb Bush, Scott Walker, Rick Santorum, and Martin O'Malley, three Republicans and a Democrat, who are probably going to run for president. They haven't officially declared that they're going to be running for president. And there were two campaign finance groups saying that they've got unofficial campaigns and they're raising money And that what they're doing is not only deceptive, but it's also illegal. There hasn't been much news since that story broke. I wonder if we'll hear more about this or if everybody thinks, oh, that's just the way it is. There's a lot of money in politics, and so what?
Well, yeah, you know, one of my colleagues, another colleague here, had a story about that over the weekend. Let me see if I can pull that up really quickly. But I think they, in fact, I think some of the sort of good government groups actually filed.
Did they?
I'm just going to see if I can find that story again real quick. But that was actually, yeah, I mean, that is, you're exactly right. We sort of all think we know who's running for president, but really the only person who has said they're running at this point is Senator Ted Cruz from Texas. He's officially announced. Of course, Senator Rand Paul is expected to officially announce tomorrow. Senator Marco Rubio officially announcing next week. But yet a number of these candidates are raising enormous amounts of money into their super PACs, especially, I guess, Jeb Bush, because he's not currently an official the way the senators are, has even a greater ability to raise money because he's not he doesn't have the limits that they have as elected officials. And so it's really sort of trailblazing this new kind of, again, another new era in campaign fundraising of, being able to, get the money into these super PACs in a way that is before you've even announced, in a way that could be skirting the intent of the law.
Our number 800-486-8655, Wayne in Holman. Hi, Wayne.
Hey, good afternoon, Kathleen.
Hi.
And to your guest. All I guess, go Badgers and go Brewers.
Yeah, go. What do you want to make a prediction? You want to make a prediction about tonight's basketball game?
Absolutely.
Okay, go ahead.
I don't miss them. I don't think I've missed a Badger game once, but anyway.
So are they going to do it tonight?
No, I think they're going to beat them.
You think Wisconsin's going to beat Duke?
Absolutely.
All right, I'm with you. I'm with you. All right.
Anyway,
on to politics. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I'll be brief. When the caller said, and you guys probably aren't going to like me much by making this comment, but when the caller said that the world is safer now because of John Kerry and Barack Obama, almost my jaw hit the concrete here. When I think about ISIL and what they are doing and what they plan to do in America and have done, I think it's probably in worse shape now than we've been in a long time. I think of the 20 Coptic Christians were beheaded and the 147 Catholic students that were singled out because they were Catholics and shot on the spot if they were identified as such. I think the war is just beginning with these goofballs, and I don't know. I'm very scared. What worries me is I don't think our enemies really fear Barack Obama. I think our friends don't trust him. I just don't know where we're headed. I don't think Israel is always being labeled as the bad guy, and Netanyahu is a crazed right winger. I think he is surrounded by people that want to destroy Israel. And even in Iran's own charter, their words are, we are going to wipe Israel off the face of the earth. I mean, those are pretty radical words, and I'd take them at their word. I think they're serious only in that regard. But I guess I'd like your guests to comment, please.
Thanks, Wayne, for the call. Lisa.
Yeah, it's such a difficult world right now, right, with the rising threat of ISIS and the emergence of Iran as such a key player in the region, and I think your caller there really expresses a lot of the concern that you hear about the ability of the president to lead on this issue and to be seen as tough and going against. And, again, back to Prime Minister Netanyahu and, the concerns that he expressed, when he was here. And, I think it's just, people have very different views about this, right, of whether, whether the concerns being raised by Netanyahu are fanning the flames or are exaggerated. I mean, obviously, the state of Israel is so potentially threatened by being surrounded by so much hostility, and then the concern they have of Iran's continued development of this nuclear facility, and again, the ability of the president to sort of lead talks and lead the discussion into sort of a new place, or is it going to just be you know, seen as a you know, weakening of the U.S. position and not standing up to these sort of hostile forces. It's you know, I think history is being written as we are sitting here, you know, and as we are sort of witnessing and watching this. And I, you know, I think it will be you know, for later to determine, you know, whether this is sort of a high point or a low point.
Yeah. And it is understandable, certainly. I mean, you can see Israel's point in some of this, that Iran has been denying a Holocaust, you know, for some time. There's been some rhetoric that has been pretty unbelievable. So sometimes you just wonder, how in the world is all of this going to be figured out? Because you have people who are so opposed, and some of their rhetoric is just going to make another side so angry that they're going to elect certain people who will talk tough to the other side. It just goes on endlessly, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, absolutely. And if you look at even, you know, the situation with Iran, you know, we're sort of, you know, are we, you know, allied with them in some sense in the campaign against ISIS in Iraq, you know,
right.
on the other side in the other struggles in the Middle East, you know, I think there's
right.
you know, it's a very complicated time. I think the rise of ISIS, you know, at a time when the country is so war-weary and the administration was trying to wind down, you know, the troop presence in Iraq and Afghanistan, and, you know, now we have this new threat that is, you know, incredibly threatening. You know, nobody, I mean, you see these, you know, hostage videos and beheadings, and then, of course, you know, the specter of a nuclear-capable Iran, you know, I mean, people, you know, I mean, it's a very difficult and complicated time, right? And, you know, I think, you know, the administration and Secretary Kerry are trying to pursue a path that they believe is you know, one that will, you know, that will, you know, bear some solutions. You know, you know, we will see.
We're welcoming more phone calls. Lisa Mascaro is our guest this hour. She covers Congress for the LA Times. And our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's @KDunnShow. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number is 800-486-8655, and we go to Rich in Appleton next. Hi, Rich.
Hi, good afternoon. I've been listening to the show here, and off and on I hear comments from different people as far as Obama not being the big powerhouse we've been looking for and everything. But I think people are forgetting that we've had presidents like that. Matter of fact, I think we just got one out of office not too long ago, and it doesn't work. We have a president in office now that is actually thinking about how this whole thing comes together. And trying to, if you want to call the doctrine like it has been called, that's fine, I guess. But trying to come up with some logical solutions and long-term solutions rather than just bombing people into submission for a year or two.
Well, that's an interesting point. Lisa?
Well, yeah, you know, I think, you know, when you start sort of saying, well, what is the alternative, you know, and especially in these talks in Iran, you know, the alternative if the talks break down, if the nuclear capacity of the Iranians increases, I mean, then what, right? You know, nobody wants to, you know, be thinking about, I think most Americans would not very much be interested in, you know, a military entanglement with Iran, right? Or, you know, so the idea of trying to get, you know, a deal that could at least, you know, start to curtail a nuclear, you know, Iran is sort of where it's headed. I was thinking back to what your caller was saying about the president, and one of my colleagues here who covers the White House, Christy Parsons, had a really interesting story over the weekend about, you know, the president's pursuit of sort of a nuclear-free world and sort of his time in the Senate and serving on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and what he learned from an older generation in the Senate, Senator Richard Lugar of Indiana, who was a huge Republican proponent of nuclear nonproliferation. And I think, you know, your caller is right. It's sort of that part of the President Obama that some people love, and it drives other people crazy, is this idea that he is this very cerebral sort of
yes.
thinking president who is trying to, you know, intellectually craft a path forward. And, you know, that is is, I think your caller, you know, raises a smart point that that's, of course, you know, part of what was Obama's, the attraction to voters in 2008 when Obama was first elected, on the heels of, you know, what some called sort of the cowboy diplomacy, if you remember, you know, of President Bush, you know, George W. Bush, and sort of leading the country into the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Of course, Afghanistan now being, you know, the longest war, you know, that we've, you know, the nation's longest war. So, you know, a reaction to that was certainly what President Obama ran on and you know, won on and has since carried out, you know, in his time, you know, but that's also what infuriates some of these stronger defense hawks, you know, who really, you know, lean into that idea of a stronger presidency. You know, but I think people forget, too, I mean, the president, you know, we did bring it into Osama bin Laden, right? You know, sort of something that gets forgotten in the end of that conversation. But, you know, it's hard. I think people see the incursions that President Putin has made into Ukraine, and, of course, as we said about the Middle East, and, you know, people think that U.S. should, you know, take more of a global policeman, you know, stronger role in fighting back on that.
Thanks very much for your call, Rich. We go to Dave in Madison. Hi, Dave.
Hi. I think that regardless of whether or not these are enemies' regimes in the Middle East fear President Obama, they fear our nuclear weapons, and they fear Israel's nuclear weapons. And just imagine, even if they did sign this peace accord and they tried to build a nuclear weapon, and they successfully did, what are they going to do to us with it? The only thing they could use it for would be a deterrent of our action.
Yeah, I think nobody, you know, a few people would like to see a sort of arms race, right? You know, a sort of escalation of, you know, nuclear arms and sort of a return to these Cold War standoffs that we saw a generation ago, right? And so I think, you know, there's not a lot of appetite in the United States for that kind of buildup. And I would imagine polling around the world shows similar. So, you know, I think that is what is trying to sort of be prevented here, but you know, these are difficult, right? It's all very difficult talks and situation to get to a resolution.
We'll take another phone call on this in a moment, but I wanted to be sure and talk about Marco Rubio for just a little while. He's going to be saying tomorrow that he's running for president. What makes him stand apart from the rest of the candidates? Is he somebody who will gain more and more followers as the months and year and a half go on here?
Yeah, Senator Rubio is a really interesting candidate right now. So, okay, of course, just to clarify, Senator Paul announcing tomorrow, Senator Rubio next
Monday.
Oh, that's
right.
You know, what happened with Senator Rubio is that he was considered, I don't know if you remember, he was considered the savior of the Republican Party. There was a big headline splashed across, you know, Time magazine at the start of early 2013. It was after the Republican defeat, you know, with Mitt Romney's defeat in the 2012 election, and the Republicans went through this enormous soul-searching process. They came out with this position paper. They called it sort of the autopsy on what had gone wrong with the strategy of 2012. And what emerged from all that soul-searching was this idea that Senator Rubio was really the future of the party. Young, Latino, can speak to a new generation, can attract immigrants and minority groups that are, you know, so missing from the Republican Party right now. And a conservative, you know, elected on the Tea Party wave, but a conservative sort of with a smile, right? Someone who is really able to put sort of a you know, kinder, gentler, you know, face on some of the sort of tough love conservative fiscal and some might say social policies. That said, Senator Rubio's rising star took a big fall about few months after that, 6 months after that, when he became part of that Gang of Eight that negotiated the immigration bill
yes.
compromise in the Senate. And he has spent the past, year or so really trying to get back into the good graces of the conservatives who sent him to Congress. A lot of the Tea Party groups and conservative groups out in the country were not pleased about his alliance with the big comprehensive immigration reform bill that he negotiated with, Democrats, Chuck mm-hmm. Schumer and the others. And so he's been really putting his nose to the grindstone mm-hmm. to come up with conservative policy papers. He has a new mm-hmm. book out.
And on that note, we have to say goodbye. So we'll
keep
looking. No, that's fine.
Yeah.
Lisa, thanks very much for being with us.
You bet.
Lisa Mascaro, our guest. It'll be interesting where all the candidates evolve when it comes to that particular issue, or if they stay where they are. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour, and thanks to KP as well for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and we'll talk about complex television shows, Hour 2.